This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about all from the comfort of your home isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is Intelligence Matters with former acting director of the CIA, Michael Morell. Brought to you by Lockheed Martin. Your mission is ours.
You know, I can see the faces of our Kurdish partners, our Syrian partners, even our Afghan partners, as they see what, you know, is nothing other than a total betrayal. And I think this will have a lot of ramifications into the future as well, because there will be other conflicts where we're going to need our local partners. Our foreign partnerships remain a cornerstone of our intelligence collection. You know, from our Five Eyes alliance, that's with the UK, Canada, you know, New Zealand, and Australia, to our, you know, our allies in the Balkans or the Middle East, you know, we've really built a worldwide web of allies who cooperate together against, you know, the hardest of targets.
So they give us intelligence.
They do, and friendly services have, you know, taken down terrorist plots against Americans, have interdicted nuclear material. They've helped us catch spies in our midst and provided us critical intelligence on our hard targets like Russia, Iran, North Korea, and China. So, you know, they're really... they're indispensable, and it's personal relations. It's just simply a critical part of the job.
Tucker Carlson accused CIA of wanting to remove President Trump from office and that it was actually acting to do so. The whistleblower was an example of that, he said. What I want to ask you, Mark, is in your 26 years of service, did you ever see any evidence of this narrative?
No. You know, first of all, the answer is a clear and unequivocal no. I think it's a utterly, you know, absurd accusation, and it actually makes me sad because it goes against the fundamental principle or fundamental premise of our role.
And to the extent that you might happen to know what somebody's personal political views are, did you ever see those views affect what that person did in the workplace?
I look back personally. Did I agree with every foreign policy decision that was made? Of course not. Yet I deployed to multiple war zones. I joke with people, I have intelligence medals from operations in areas of the world in which I didn't personally view our policy was correct. It didn't matter at all.
Mark Polymeropoulos was a CIA operations officer who served the agency for 26 years in a variety of overseas and headquarters assignments. Mark retired from the agency this past June, and he agreed to join me on the podcast to talk about some of the narratives in the public domain about CIA and politics. We'll be right back after a quick break to hear from our exclusive sponsor, Lockheed Martin. I'm Michael Morell, and this is Intelligence Matters.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Mark, welcome to Intelligence Matters. It is great to have you on the show.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
People need to know that you and I are friends and our families are friends. I think it's important for my listeners to know that. What it probably means for you, Mark, is that I probably need to be tougher on you than I am on most guests. So be prepared, pal.
Not a problem.
Okay. I actually want to start in a little bit different place than I had originally planned. And I know that you have spent some time in the Middle East, and I know that you have spent some time actually working with the Kurds in Iraq, which are a little bit different than the Kurds in Syria. But I really, Mark, wanted to get your reaction from someone who's actually been on the ground, have actually had to work with folks like the Kurds to advance American interests. I wanted to get your reaction to what's happened the last couple of days, and to particularly what's happening today with the Turks rolling into northern Syria.
Sure. I think when I saw the news over the last several days of what what the administration had decided, and then overnight the Turkish incursion, it's almost a punch to the gut for many of us who have at least for myself, for two decades served really on the front lines helping train these indigenous forces. It's on a personal level for me, because this is not, talking about kind of geopolitics. This is face to face with allies, whether they're in Afghanistan, Iraq, or Syria, who really put all their faith in the U.S. government, and even more particular in those of us who are on the ground training them or working with them. And so, I can see the faces of our Kurdish partners, our Syrian partners, even our Afghan partners, as they see what, is nothing other than a total betrayal. And I think this will have a lot of ramifications into the future as well, because there will be other conflicts where we're going to need our local partners.
And they're now going to wonder whether they can trust us for the long term.
That's right, undoubtedly. And again, I recall there was a great Kurdish leader who, this is over 20 years ago. We were living up in the mountains in Kurdistan, and I had given them our promises of future American support. And I think, the Kurds are a special lot because they've been betrayed over the years by everyone from the Iranians to the Israelis to Saddam. But after my promises of a future, democratic Iraq, when we rid the country of Saddam, he took me aside and he said, look, we're going to do this for ourselves. We need your support. But everything we do is not based on the American ideal. It really is going to be based on just your promise of support. So I think, even the Kurds who understood realpolitik very well, this is really a dark day for not only for the United States, but for a lot of intelligence and special operations warriors who spend time on the front lines with these forces.
And I imagine, going forward, whether you're in the intelligence community or whether you're in the military and you're having conversations with indigenous forces somewhere else that we might want to support, that it's going to be tough. It's going to be tough to make the case, right, that we're going to be with you for the long term, and you're going to be able to count on the United States, right? It's going to be tough to keep a straight face and say that.
That's right. And, the Middle East is a small area. So everyone is going to look back kind of on what's occurred over the last several hours and days. And this is really going to hurt us into the future. Again, this is from the ground level. To me, it was a punch in the gut. I think there's a lot of intelligence officers and special operations officers who are having some sleepless nights because they're looking at the faces of the individuals that we have betrayed.
Mark, this is the first interview that you've done ever. You retired from the agency earlier this summer. You've done some writing. You've shared your thoughts with the public on several different issues. One of those is what we're going to talk about at length, which is, how does politics affect CIA, and is CIA political? So I really want to get into that discussion. But this being your first interview and the fact that you've written a handful of things, why did you decide to share your views publicly after a life in the clandestine service?
Sure. Well, after 26 years really all spent, in the shadows, I think I wanted to come and give context to the American people about the organization that I really so deeply believe in. That was not just my job, but it was, it was a calling. It was my passion. I think the CIA has a soul, it has a culture, and there's so much good that we do. So, quite simply, I just wanted to write and talk about it.
So, Mark, before we get into the discussion of politics and CIA, let me ask you a few questions about your career. You started at the agency in 1993. How did you end up there?
Sure. Well, you know, I grew up in New Jersey, just really a regular middle-class kid, you know, listening to Bon Jovi and Springsteen and going to the Jersey Shore. I think you'd actually be surprised how many New Jerseyites are at CIA. I think former director John Brennan as well.
Yes.
Is one. But really, two things led me to CIA, and, you know, this is just, you know, kind of on a personal level. One was I read James Michener's book, Caravans, which was about a young Foreign Service officer in Afghanistan, and I was mesmerized by this, you know, Lawrence of Arabia-type story. And then the second one, which was really memorable, was a trip. My father, who was a college professor, he was teaching in Algeria. So my father and his best friend and I, when I was 10 years old, we drove 1,000 miles through the Sahara Desert in Algeria in a Volkswagen minibus. And so I became completely hooked on the Middle East then. And after undergrad and grad school at Cornell, I was really hired into the only job I've ever had.
You know, this reminds me of a conversation I had with somebody who's undercover, but somebody you know well, somebody who was the head of the Counterterrorism Center when I was the deputy director. And he told me that one weekend he had gone to graduation for a relative of his, and how he went to the graduation and was talking with all the kids and how disappointed he was. And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, I asked them about their overseas experience, and they told me about London and Rome and Paris. And right. What I wanted to hear is somebody who had hiked their way across Africa."
That's right.
That's what I wanted to hear. Yeah. So sounds like you got that right. So, Mark, you started as an analyst, right? You did that for 4 years. Then you switched operations. What made you make that change?
That's right. Well, so
you started in my side of the agency.
I did. It's a really interesting story because actually, so many of my first experiences on the analytics side shaped the operational side of my career later on. But I'll start. You know, I started in 1993 on the Afghan desk, and interestingly, we had begun tracking a young supporter of the worldwide Islamic terrorist movement, a man called Osama bin Laden, and I actually co-authored one of the first papers ever written on these Afghan war veterans. And then even in the third week of my analyst training, the third week when I was on the job at CIA, that's when Amir Emil Khanzi killed several of our colleagues outside the front gate.
January of 93.
And so, you know, even as an analyst, you know, these were signs of what I would spend really the majority of my career on. But as for my analytic career, I think in 1995, after a TDY, a temporary duty assignment, on a trip to the Middle East, I decided I wanted to switch tracks. And I came back and I talked to my group chief, someone who I think you know very well. He was John Brennan. And I went into his office and I said I'd like to become a case officer. And very quickly, and in retrospect, too quickly, he agreed it would be a great idea to switch tracks. So I think, looking back, that was clear maybe I was not the crack analyst that I thought I was. But off I went into the DO, and then much later on when John was the director and I was in a field management role in the Middle East, I reminded him of this story and we laughed. And it's you know, in truth, he kept me in the agency. So that was a good
you
thing.
You would have made a great analyst. I'm absolutely certain of that. So, Mark, what can you tell us in an unclassified setting here? We got to keep reminding people of that, about the training program that operations officers go through.
Sure. You know, I think in a nutshell, it's very close to the reality of work and life in the field. It is that good. It's a lot about time management. It's about testing yourself and your ability to operate alone. And it's not for everyone. You know, people do fail, and that's okay. You know, there is a washout rate.
So it's not like 5-year-old soccer where everybody gets a trophy at the end.
No, everyone does not get a trophy in the end. And look, in the end, you have to be able to master the core skills of a case officer, which is how to, you know, detect surveillance, how to handle agents with, you know, top-notch tradecraft, and then, of course, the core business of spotting, assessing, developing, and recruiting. I think I would often marvel even years later with real-world operations, and I look back and I would say that, you know, what I learned in my training was spot on.
So, Mark, what is it like to recruit another human being to spy for the United States?
That's a great question. I love that question because it goes to the heart of why I really loved the job as a case officer. Because, you know, ultimately it's about, I think, the most basic of human personal relationships. I mean, I call it a romance, and then it's a marriage. You know, it's ultimately about getting close enough to another human being that you're able to assess their motivation to a point where you garner their agreement to betray their country. And that's an incredibly intimate relationship. And in the end, you're looking at someone who says to you, "I'm going to put my life in your hands. Can you, think about that as a responsibility of a young officer? There's probably no other job like that, in the USG or even anywhere.
So once they say yes, you really have two jobs, right? One is to acquire the intelligence that they have access to, and the other is to keep them safe.
Yes, right.
And that is that's a huge responsibility that the agency takes extraordinarily seriously.
And you have that responsibility at a very young age.
And then on the flip side, right, the flip side is the importance of keeping our officers, our operations officers, our case officers who are interacting with these assets safe. And you had an experience where somebody who worked for you was actually killed by someone that we thought was an asset. Can you talk about that a little bit?
That's right. I think, this was what, every day you hoped and prayed would never happen. I'll never forget standing in front of several hundred officers at a station and announcing the death of our colleague, and to many who was a great friend. This was a truly awful experience, and I can still hear that the howls of one officer when she heard the news. It was absolutely gut wrenching. I can't even recall, frankly, what I said that day. I remember taking the initial phone call that our officer had been killed, and immediately calling in all hands. I saw my wife at the embassy as well, and to this day she said she had never seen such a look on my face. She knew something was wrong. And I'll tell you, even today I have intense feelings of guilt for what occurred, because ultimately I was in charge, and I've about a billion times gone through my mind how I personally failed. Years later, when I received my promotion to the senior intelligence service ranks, my first thought was that I did not deserve that, as that I had lost someone under my command. I have intense feelings of what occurred, so you try to take these feelings and kind of impart this on to the next generation of agency leaders, because in our work, this unfortunately does happen, and you have to be prepared for it. I'll kind of finish this with one day I was having dinner with Deputy CENTCOM commander, and I told him of my struggles coming to terms with the death of one officer, and he responded that he really dealt with this on an industrial scale.
Sure,
and
sure.
So that was really sobering, and it's a tough business.
So let's switch and talk about politics in the CIA. But I think in order to set the predicate for that, I need to ask you a couple things. So as an operations officer, you broadly did three things, right? You recruited spies. You built and maintained liaison relationships with foreign intelligence services. And you helped conduct covert action. Let's set the last one aside, because we probably shouldn't talk about that.
Right.
But talk for a minute about the importance of recruitment operations to national security.
Sure. Look, there's no substitute in my mind for what is in essence a human spy. So for a penetration of a terrorist group who could provide information on plots to attack Americans, to a penetration of a prime minister's office of a country who's negotiating a trade deal with us, or penetration of a hostile nuclear program. These are operations that could inform us of the most detailed plans of our adversaries. It's obviously one element of the intelligence picture. There's signals intelligence as well, as where we're listening on the communications of our allies. But in my view, and this I kind of go back to the bottom line in dealing with a human spy. These are someone who can provide us ground truth, could maybe provide us documents, can answer our tasking. It's an interactive relationship, and that's really unmatched.
Yeah, that's what it's that ability to go back and ask questions,
right?
Follow up. What did you mean by that? What did you mean by this? Can you answer that question? Can you answer this question? That really, I think, sets it apart from the other ints, from the other collection systems, right? Those can't do that,
right?
But a human source can. Did you, when you were in the field, running assets and then managing case officers who are running assets, did you see the impact of your work?
Oh, I mean, I think we can have extraordinary impact. And, in the later stages of my career, when I had, senior operational leadership positions in several of the mission centers, I would go back and I would kind of tell the following to people that I would recall five or six times in my career where the front page stories in the Washington Post or New York Times were the results of our operational work. Of course, no mention of CIA, but, that feeling that you were a part of history, that, perhaps you helped shape history as a, and I'm not exaggerating on that, that's unmatched. I can give a example of an impact that was, you know, not geopolitical in nature, more personal though, is that in South Asia, where I was managing one of our bases, we were tracking a terrorist target, and this terrorist target had killed one of our officers several years prior, and this target was still continuing to plan operations against Americans. So we put agents on the ground, recruited agents on the ground, and over months worked against this target where we finally had him on the X.
And we finally located him.
We located him, and we called in an airstrike, and we killed the terrorist. And on the impact of that, you know, I'll say that later that night, this is from 10,000 miles away, we called our officer's widow, who was all the way back in the United States, and she thanked us. Mm. And, you know, that remains a really proud moment of my time in CIA. And, that, you know, to me, it's certainly operational impact.
We're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor, and we'll be right back with more of our discussion with Mark.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Okay, Mark, now talk about the importance to the United States of America, right, of our relationships, CIA's relationships with foreign intelligence services.
Sure, and I think this is something that's not often really talked enough about in our line of business, but really our foreign partnerships remain a cornerstone of our intelligence collection. You know, from our Five Eyes alliance that's with the UK, Canada, you know, New Zealand and Australia, to our, you know, our allies in the Balkans or the Middle East, you know, we've really built a worldwide web of allies who cooperate together against, you know, the hardest of targets.
So they give us intelligence.
They do. And friendly services have, you know, taken down terrorist plots against Americans, have interdicted nuclear material. They've helped us catch spies in our midst and you know, provided us critical intelligence on our hard targets like Russia, Iran, North Korea, and China. So, you know, they're indispensable. And as operational managers in the field and headquarters, we spend a huge amount of time nurturing these relationships. And again, it goes back to what I talked about before in terms of recruitment operations. This is different, but there's an art to liaison operations as well, because again, it's all human contact,
right.
And it's personal relations. And it's simply a critical part of the job.
Okay. So with that as background, now we're going to get to the political discussion. And maybe the way to do this, Mark, is for me to lay out some of the narratives that are in the public domain about CIA,
sure.
CIA and politics, and the influence of politics on CIA. So I think the first narrative is that the agency has a political agenda, that the agency plays in domestic politics here in the United States, mm-hmm. that it wants to influence politics here in the United States. In fact, Tucker Carlson, a Fox News commentator, accused CIA of wanting to remove President Trump from office and that it was actually acting to do so. The whistleblower was an example of that, he said.
Right.
What I want to ask you, Mark, is in your 26 years of service, did you ever see any evidence of this narrative?
No. You know, first of all, the answer is a clear and unequivocal no. And, you know, it's a you know, I see this in the press, and you asked previously why I wanted to speak out. So, you know, this is one of the reasons to address questions like this, because I think it's a utterly, you know, absurd accusation. And it actually makes me sad because it goes against the fundamental principle or the fundamental premise of our role, which was to protect the American people. So to me, that narrative is really deeply insulting, but I suppose it does need to be addressed.
Yeah. In fact, somebody who I grew up with actually called me after the Tucker Carlson thing and said, does the CIA really do that?
Right.
So these narratives matter. So it matters that people who have worked there and have worked there recently,
right,
like you did, can speak out and say, it's not true.
It's not true at all.
Okay, so there's another narrative out there, right? Let me back up a minute. So this doesn't mean that agency officers don't have their own personal political views,
course.
Right? Yeah. Of course they do. Do people talk about them in the workplace?
So, you know, ordinarily, no, we're too busy. I mean, that's kind of the, you know, what I tell people. And, you know, when I was at CIA, we don't even have access to Twitter inside the building.
Right.
I mean, perhaps, you know, on, you know, the operations center does, but we didn't follow the tweets. We didn't follow what was happening. We're just, you know, we're too busy in the end. You know, there are, but of course, I have close friends in the agency, you know, a select few who I would socialize on the side. Do I know their politics? Maybe a little bit. But I can also tell you, I couldn't, if we named 20 CIA officers that I work closely with, other than maybe some of my close friends, I have no idea who they even voted for. I think, you know, what we did pay attention to, and this is because it was part of our job. So, for example, in a congressional election, you know, the oversight committee members may change. Well, that's a big deal to us because we do have a lot of dealings with oversight. So that is of interest. Who is now going to be on HPSI or CISI? But again, at the end of the day, talking politics in the workplace is not a prime job duty of an organization that is designed to protect America.
And to the extent that you might happen to know what somebody's personal political views are, did you ever see those views affect what that person did in the workplace or decisions that that person made about their responsibilities?
No, you know, again, it's first of all, the answer is no. And it's, again, a question I find it's almost amazing that we have to address this. I mean, I look back personally, did I agree with every foreign policy decision that was made? Of course not. Yet I deployed to multiple war zones, carried out the best of my duties, my abilities, my operational duties. You know, I joke with people, I have intelligence medals from operations in areas of the world in which I didn't personally view our policy was correct. It didn't matter at all.
So, Mark, one of the other narratives that is out there is that because of the president's decisions, because of his behavior, because of his critique of our allies, because of his embracing of some of our adversaries, and I could go on and on here,
right,
that he's personally made the job of agency officers harder. Did you see anything in either terms of recruitment operations or in terms of our relationships with foreign intelligence services, which is why I wanted to talk about those earlier,
sure,
that would be evidence of that narrative?
So look, I think this is actually a really useful narrative to ponder, and I've thought a lot about this, because it would be very easy for us to say, you know, yes, because of the president's unorthodox style, you know, he's a disruptor for the international world order, you know, the tweets sometimes insulting foreign leaders, et cetera. But really, upon close analysis, you know, to me, that just does not fly, and that's a really good thing. So, you know, in terms of recruitments, I mean, I don't think it has made our job of recruiting foreign assets more difficult because, you know, as I kind of consider what are the factors in which a foreign official would decide to spy for the United States, you know, these are all really personal motivations. Whether it's, you know, individual needs based on, you know, financial need for, you know, a sick relative or education for their children, or maybe dissatisfaction in the workplace, they're a minority, a religious minority in a country where there is a glass ceiling, or maybe they've been passed over for promotion. But none of these have to do with whether or not, President Trump has made a tweet or has, you know, insulted another foreign leader or disrupted the world order. I think, you know, again, it's a recruiting assets is a very personal decision for the agent to say yes. And so I don't think there has been an effect. In terms of liaison, you know, this is where...
relationships, you know, with foreign intelligence services.
I'm sorry. So yes, so liaison is our, you know, well-established relationship with foreign services over, you know, over the entire globe. And look, liaison is very well attuned to American politics, probably more so than we are. They're very smart. And so look, in my assignments after the elections in 2016, I was obliged to spend really a significant amount of time with senior foreign intelligence service officials who were, you know, they were curiously assessing
us
and,
sure,
and the new president and his style. And you know, they were under some pressure from their masters as well. And they'd be asked at times, you know, maybe to brace us about something that the White House had put forward. But look, we dealt with this very professionally. And I believe correctly by just, we would note that we were all intelligence professionals, that it was best to ignore the politics. And then focus on our arena, which is, you know, really building and even strengthening the bilateral ties between respective services. And, you know, there's I look back, there is tremendous historic precedent for this. So I think in one of CIA's finest hours in the Middle East was our link to the Jordanian security services. But this was years ago. This was to Jordanian then King Hussein. If you recall, after the Saddam invaded Kuwait, the U.S. and Jordan essentially severed bilateral ties.
The king supported the Iraqis.
He did. But the CIA maintained the ties to the Jordanians and was the kind of the sole entity that was able to kind of rebuild the entire bilateral relationship. And look at today, you know, Jordan is one of our indispensable allies. So just to go back to the original question, no, I think our work with liaison under this White House is has flourished. You know, I will note, I think it's a question if one asked to senior FBI or Department of State officials, they may have a different answer. Those are organizations that I think have had a bit of a tougher time than we are.
So, Mark, maybe one more thought just to underscore what you said about liaison relationships is, in my experience, they not only survive tough political times, but they become the bedrock on which you rebuild a political relationship down the road, which I think is exactly what happened with Jordan.
Right.
I think CIA's relationships with other countries is going to be really important here going forward.
That's right. I agree.
So one more narrative, Mark, that's out there, and that is that unlike the Bush and Obama administrations, this one, the Trump administration, particularly the president himself, has little interest in intelligence, is not paying attention, has little interest in what the agency has to say. Is that narrative accurate?
No, I think it's not accurate at all. And I think, first of all, you have to separate, the administration from the president himself. In my time under this current White House, and again, I retired in June of this year, there was a huge appetite for intelligence. The National Security Council, for example, were voracious consumers, the various national security advisors we've gone through. And I think, a perfect example of this was the U.S. government's response to the brazen Russian attempts to kill Sergei Skripal in the U.K. In March of 2018. There was a well-coordinated and really well-executed USG response led by the CIA, working through the White House. And it really was a textbook example of the administration turning to the CIA to really kind of put the screws in the Russians. So this was a shining moment. And that, to me, is not an example at all of an administration.
If I remember correctly, the president didn't want to take action, right?
And that's
and was,
where,
was ultimately talked into it, right, by his senior advisors.
Look, I cannot comment on President Trump himself. And, I'm not a member, nor was I part of the briefing team. That's a separate subject. But I'll note there is historic precedent for presidents to have a less than stellar desire for briefings. There's a famous Washington, vignette. If you recall, many years ago during the Clinton administration, there was a small plane that crashed on the White House lawn. And the joke at that time was that then DCIA James Woolsey was trying to get in to see President Clinton, who wasn't taking his PDB ever, his presidential daily brief. And, Woolsey would tell that joke himself. So my point on that is, let's not judge the administration and their interest in intelligence just by what we hear about, only the president.
So in your experience over the last few years, Secretary of State's interest in intelligence?
That's correct.
High?
I think it probably was a bit different under Secretary of State Tillerson. He had a unique management style.
But Pompeo?
Pompeo, for sure, who, got to know our building very well and was an avid consumer when he was our director. And
Secretary of Defense, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs?
Absolutely. Our counterparts at DOD were enormously interested, primarily because of all the hotspots around the world.
So with all this... with all of these narratives out there, right? CIA officers can't help to read about this stuff in the paper, right? How would you assess the morale at CIA, given all this, the fluidity of all the politics and it's the way it's swirling around?
Sure. Look, and as a senior leader when I left, I was hyper attuned to this because this is kind of the health of our organization. But my conclusion again, and this is despite kind of the political storm in Washington, the morale was very high. There are young men and women who want to serve their country really in a unique line of work. I think, one of the key points that we stress, and which is true, is that the CIA today has, sufficient resources to do our job and enjoys significant support on the Hill for our activities. And that's not always the case. So we have to really focus on that. And I think our officers know that. It's a place where, you know, diversity and inclusion is practiced, and this is really important. But, you know, back to the political side of the question, CIA officers are always cranky. So I think morale is high, but we're always cranky.
Particularly analysts, if I remember correctly.
And then look, you know, if you remember under President Obama, and you were, of course, there at the time, look, the National Security Council was a really bloated and times, you know, stultifying entity. And we complained all the time about a lack of timely decision making. So I would think, I'd say morale is high and CIA officers remain, you know, appropriately cranky.
Mark, did you, as a senior leader, have to talk to your troops about all of this?
So, you know, I think it would be negligent if we did not. So the answer is yes. And so, you know, in my last job, I would meet and greet every officer from every career track in our mission center, whether it be a support officer, operations officer, targeting officer, an analyst.
So you had all these people working for you in this new reorganization
yes.
that John Brennan put in place.
That's right. And in their orientations, I would make sure and come and kind of address that, you know, that giant elephant in the room. And I would simply say to ignore the politics and just, you know, put your head down and get to work. And I think that really did work because at the end of the day, I go back to the morale. People came to the agency really for the right reasons. And they were, you know, they looked at the front page. You know, my last job was running operations in Europe and Russia. If you can't get motivated every day to come to work after what the Russians did to us in 2016, you know, it's probably a wrong line of work for you.
Right. So, Mark, just a couple of more questions here. What are the things that you're going to miss about going to work every day at the agency?
So, you know, I look back on kind of several moments that I think about all the time, you know, and both, you know, in the field and at headquarters. But, you know, I recall walking from my apartment in a Middle Eastern capital. You know, it was a place we were under heavy scrutiny from a hostile intelligence service. You know, leading a small group of men and women at a station, walking up to the embassy at night, and you know, you see the American flag under that spotlight, and that to me was inspiring, not only for, you know, officers at the embassy and the station, but also, you know, many in the host country who believed in the American ideal. You know, I still get goosebumps about those days, and then I talked about before my feelings of, you know, CIA being a family. You know, when I was in Afghanistan, my mom died. And I was serving on a frontline base along the Pak-Afghan border. And, you know, a return to the United States to New Jersey was going to take multiple helicopter flights and fixed-wing flights to make it home for the funeral. Yet our helicopter pilots, who were, you know, military veterans from the special operations community and probably the most accomplished on the planet, you know, they flew me through terrible weather to get back home. And I remember being on the headset in the helicopter telling them to turn around. You know, we were in a narrow mountain pass and the weather was terrible, and I was worried about the safety of the air crew as well. And when we finally got to the base and we landed, you know, they said, look, we did this for you. You know, we know what happened to your mom. And so, you know, I mean, to me, you know, how do you not have incredible loyalty to an organization that has men and women like that? And, you know, CIA to me is a family. I think it has a soul, you know, it has a beating heart. You know, I never had a boring day in 26 years. And so I was really lucky to be a part of that. So sure, I will certainly miss it.
Mark, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Mark Polymeropoulos. I'm Michael Morrell. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters.
This has been the Intelligence Matters Podcast with former acting director of the CIA, Michael Morrell. Brought to you by Lockheed Martin. Your mission is ours. The podcast is produced by Olivia Gassis, Jamie Benson, and Jake Rosen. If you haven't already, subscribe, rate, and review wherever you download podcasts. You can follow the show on Twitter at Intel Matters Pod and follow Michael at Michael J. Morrell. Intelligence Matters is a production of CBS News Radio.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.